Russell in Carmel, California. It's tape number 391. It's June the 1st, and this is side one. I'm sure that many of you are interested in that plane crash that went down leaving O'Hare Airport this past week. The casualty list came to 272, but it's impossible to know who was on that airplane, why it went down, or if it was sabotaged by just looking at a figure. The headlines in every paper, of course, carried 272 killed in crash. There were people from Saudi Arabia, from the Netherlands. There were 24 persons going to the book publishing convention in Los Angeles, out of the meeting in Los Angeles, the booksellers, 24 people that were to join that group were killed. Now, if you look at your newspaper last week with the casualty list and go down the alphabetical order, you come to the name Regnery, Henry F., South Bend, Indiana. And any person who's done research or any reading on political assassinations or on the intelligence community knows the name Regnery, Henry Regnery. I think we originally published the books by William Buckley. He's been a CIA publisher. He's worked with CIA agents, and those particular publishers like Arlington House, Regnery, Zodiac, they receive a manuscript and they let a certain amount out, but they edit to protect the agency. So what's left out, what we don't know, is what they know and are not allowed to tell us or will not tell us, don't want to tell us. But Regnery was the publisher for Gary Powers. Gary Powers, the pilot of the U-2 plane that went down over the Soviet Union, that broke up the peace talk between Khrushchev and Eisenhower, the one that the fatal plane crash, the peace conference in 1960 was called off. Eisenhower told us because of that, beware of the power of the military-industrial. Gary Powers had taken his second book. He wrote one on the U-2. His second book was on the CIA downing the U-2 to break the d'entente. I understand he had allegations about James McCord of Watergate fame fueling that U-2 plane or working with the U-2. He took this manuscript to Regnery, and just about 2 weeks later, Gary Powers had a fatal plane crash over Los Angeles where there was an explosion and his helicopter went down. That book has never been released, but was in the hands of Regnery. And now, just a short time after Powers' death, Regnery himself was on the DC-10 when the 272 people were killed. He's only one of a large number. But remember, after George de Morenschild died, another very, very important witness to the Kennedy assassination, his manuscript was never released by his so-called friends, his wife, his attorney. Dead agent, dead manuscript. William Sullivan, Gary Powers, and de Morenschild were my three most important witnesses to unravel the Kennedy assassination. All were murdered within a short time span. But Regnery, the publisher, is dead, and he went down on that plane crash. Along with him, as I say, there were 24 from the book distribution convention in Los Angeles, where the very top people from Playboy magazine, the foreign correspondents, the top desks, the day-to-day workers, four of their most important persons were also killed on the plane crash. And that reminded me of what Mort Saul wrote about Hugh Hefner and Playboy and Mae Brussels in his book Heartland. I don't know how many of you have read it or have it. You should get it. It's put out by Harcourt Brace. It came out in 1976. And Mort Saul was outraged that Hugh Hefner would go to such lengths to insult me and insult my research, and he was putting him down. This was after the meeting in Boston, the assassination conspiracy conference, and Sherman Skolnick and Mae Brussels were hitting pretty hard at all the phonies there and the sabotage and the cover-ups that were going on in Boston at what was supposed to be a conspiracy conference. So Playboy sent Mordecai Richler from Montreal, the home of Permandex, out to California and to Chicago to see Sherman Skolnick, and he pulled up at the house and kept the cab running and just to see me and spent a few moments at the house, then wrote this article in Playboy trying to put me down. Mort Saul wrote in this book, and I might have quoted on another tape or on KLRB a while back, but I'm going to repeat it. He wrote, "How many more have to die before some Americans realize that murder is not a way of life? Too many have lost America. They brought her their lust. They could never love her. For one, Hugh Hefner, who's now reduced to attacking Mae Brussel, who's an assassination researcher who pursues the murders among us selflessly. What did Garfield say in Body and Soul? What are you going to do? Kill me? Everybody dies. Hefner sent a prominent novelist to ordain her a paranoid. America's poet laureate Don McLean reminds us, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you." I was complimented that he wrote, "How many have to die before people wake up and realize what is going on?" And, of course, Hugh Hefner has lost four of his top aides in that same plane crash with Henry Regnery. And when you cover up murders, when you cover up conspiracies and assassinations, you simply get more murders. And I'm going to be specific about another cover-up a month ago and then the murder that followed on that. It just will not wash away by looking the other way. And single murders become group murders, and group murders become genocide, and that's why the individual murder is so important. If you want information on the plane crash, I'm going to give you the address on the sheet here for those people that don't know the work of Sherman Skolnick. He did extensive work on the sabotage of the plane that Dorothy Hunt was on 7 years ago, and he's known for his work in Chicago in that area, and he has a lot of information on the downing of this DC-10. Sherman believes that there's going to be more airplane crashes and that there was a plan to sabotage the Israeli plane, the El Al, which leaves from Chicago and goes right to Israel, directly to Israel. And that on his telephone tapes, which he has a hotline, and you can send him some money for mailing lists or bibliographies, but he does not answer personal mail. But you can call the hotline, and I'll give you the number here on the printed sheet, and get information about that plane crash. He has it on 20 telephones going all the time, around the clock, 24 hours a day. And you can pick up your information. And he thinks that that was the plane crash wasn't caused by a bolt at all, that it was caused by a rocket on the ground that the PLO had used in Paris, and that they were testing it here in Chicago, and they would use it for further airplanes, that the bolt story is a cover-up. There may be some loose bolts in the DC-10s, but he thinks that that's a cover-up and that it was a ground rocket that went off at 500 feet. They go up to about 1,800 feet, and it's not detectable, except that you can tell by the smoke, the color of the smoke. It was different than the ordinary plane crash, and he has the physical evidence and reason to believe that the engine didn't just fall off this airplane, that a rocket hit it, and everything disintegrated and went into a ball of fire. You might have noticed that with the exception of Mr. and Mrs. Wax, who worked for Playboy, and she had just written a book, I didn't see any biography of any of the persons on that airplane. Usually if there's prominent people or people that are known, they tell you a little bit about them. There's been a total wipeout except for Mrs. Wax, because she just had a book published. And outside of that, there hasn't been anything that I've read, and usually the New York Times carries wonderful obituaries, and they haven't had anything on the plane crash in Chicago. A federal judge was murdered in San Antonio. We'll go into that a little bit. Herbert Wood, hearing an involved conspiracy case in narcotics. A radical lawyer in the Bay Area, Faye Stender, was shot and is near death in critical condition. They don't know whether she's going to live or die. Just 2 weeks ago, Dr. Charles Frankel of the State Department and his wife and two neighbors were murdered in White Plains, New York. They believe they might have the suspects on that. 982 Vietnamese refugees face certain death. That was in the paper this week. A key aide to Khomeini was shot and wounded, one of his closest aides. A general and two colonels were killed in Madrid, Spain. A bomb went off and killed three in Jerusalem and wounded 13 more on a crowded bus. Two Croatian, Yugoslavian radical terrorists were murdered with their own bombs that they were making in Los Angeles. They have caused bombs and murders in the airports in Los Angeles, in New York, at the airport in New York, and these Croatians spent a very short time in jail and get out very quickly. But before their bomb could hit somebody else, their little bomb factory went off and two were killed in Los Angeles. 39 people were killed in Nicaragua this week. 26 of them were rebels. Premier Bousif, the Prime Minister of Mauritania, was killed in a plane crash. He was on his way to an economic meeting of West African leaders. This was a definite political murder. He took power April the 6th in a bloodless coup. By May the 27th, he was dead. And he was, in quotes, working with a fragile equilibrium between the Arabs and blacks in Morocco and in his own country, in Mauritania. His plane went into the ocean, and he is dead. This was quite a week. The Jimmy Carter assassination plot was dropped. There's an article in the National Enquirer, of all places. No, Midnight. I'm sorry, Midnight, June the 5th. Just on the stands, or get it if you miss it by the time you get this tape. There's a photograph of that Raymond Lee Harvey and the Secret Service chasing him. All charges were dropped on that case, and for those of you who don't have the tapes, I've done one or two tapes mentioning that assassination plot, and they're off. The Arab and Iranian troops are fighting each other now near the largest oil refinery in the world, the site of the largest refinery, Abadan. Three more deaths there. There were 21 killed this week and 102 injured over oil. A Swiss diplomat was murdered in San Salvador. If you've been following what's going on in that country, 14 students were killed in May 22nd, and in 23 people were killed down there May 8th outside a cathedral where they were meeting. The soldiers fired into a group, and 14 more were killed on May 22nd. And in retaliation, a San Salvadorian education minister and his driver were killed May 23rd, and a Swiss diplomat has been murdered there in an ambush on May 31st. I have files of Nicaragua, Guatemala, and San Salvador, and there are a lot of deaths taking place right now every single day in those areas. Federal Judge Herbert Wood, Jr. in San Antonio was hearing a very extensive narcotics conspiracy case described in the New York Times as a very important case, and he walked out of his doorway and he was shot, a single shot, and the FBI has come in to find out who the killer was. But the judge, the federal judge who lived in the area hearing the case, ignored the death of a primary witness 1 month earlier, and the result of ignoring these stories, as I said before, only compounds them. If the New York Times, April the 30th, 1979, exactly 30 days before the judge was murdered, there's an article, "Question Raised in the Death of a Former Drug Agent." And this is in San Antonio, Texas, involving the same case. "Mystery Surrounds the Death of the Drug Agent." He was one of our most famous or well-known informers working in Mexico and in the Texas area. He was caught on what they called was a bribery charge and put into jail. And right after he was in jail, he went into a coma where he stayed for 4 months, and then he died. They were supposed to be putting him in a protective section because he was a federal drug informer. And they brought out a New York City pathologist to, in quotes, shed light on this particular case. His name was Sane Barrio, 42 years old. And they believe that they found some strychnine poisoning in his food, in the peanut butter, and there was strychnine in his urine. They found strychnine, according to the April 30th story, in his urine, and he was described, Mr. Barrio, as a supervisor for the Drug Enforcement Administration in Mexico. And after 10 days in jail, he had these convulsions after eating peanut butter sandwich, and there were suspicions that he had been poisoned. 1 day later, the Washington Post, May the 1st, 1979, carried the article that put everybody's mind to ease that the drug informer had not been eating strychnine. The article is called, "Coroner Says Drug Sleuth Choked on His Prison Sandwich." The medical examiner ruled that Sande Alexandro Barrio, the celebrated Drug Enforcement Administration agent, died as a long-delayed result of choking on a peanut butter sandwich. Barrio was noted for his undercover investigations throughout the world. He got convulsions and never regained consciousness. Dr. David Spain, a New York University clinical pathologist, said there was no poison at the autopsy. Even though he was in the coma for months, he allegedly died of bronchial pneumonia, comma, a complication of partial brain damage, comma, secondary to airway obstruction by a peanut butter sandwich. It reminds me of Jimi Hendrix, the rock musician, and Mama Cass, both dying in London from choking on some food, dying on their vomit. Many rock musicians died this way. And then the Washington Post said the report of strychnine poisoning was the result of a misinterpretation. Now, when this kind of thing goes on, where a noted federal agent, a man who's worked hard throughout the world trying to uncover narcotics dealing in Mexico and throughout the world, is put into protective, in quotes, custody, such as Lee Harvey Oswald had in the Dallas jail, and gets a peanut butter sandwich and stays in a coma for months and dies. And he died 1 month before the federal judge was killed outside his front door. Yet the federal judge did a little better work on why a witness to the case he was hearing was murdered. He might have uncovered something before both of them were dead. I didn't believe the story about the major agent choking on his peanut butter sandwich. I put it in a pile of articles to save and follow later, and sure enough, 1 month later, the federal judge got it. Now, I want to talk about the radical lawyer in the Bay Area. Some of you don't know her name. She wrote a book on prison problems and George Jackson and letters that she had corresponded with George Jackson. Her name is Faye Stender. Faye is 47 years old. She's married to Marvin Stender, an attorney. She's an attorney. And she got a reputation in the early 70s, 71, 72, 73, working with Huey Newton and corresponding with George Jackson when he was at Soledad Prison. She's represented prisoners up till 1973 and was known during the anti-war years up in the Bay Area as being a radical and working with people in San Quentin. A gentleman came in the house. I shouldn't call him a gentleman. He came to the house in the morning, 1:30 in the morning. Her son answered the door. He asked specifically for Faye Stender by name. He tied up her son, Neil. Her daughter was asleep. They tied up another house guest. The person who came in didn't intend to kill the other three. And then he shot Faye in the head, in the arms, the chest. And she's, as I say, in critical condition right now. They don't know if she'll live, and if she lives, she might be paralyzed. Faye was down here. I met her here in San Francisco, in the Carmel area, when I was active with these particular prisoners, the Soledad brothers, the San Quentin Six. You never could get her to defend them on a conspiracy charge. She didn't believe in conspiracies. It didn't matter to her who killed John Kennedy. She could care less who killed Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. She never cared about the Los Angeles Police Department supplying the guns when George Jackson was killed, or the way the San Quentin Six trial went. She stayed in the background and out of that. On the surface, like Tom Hayden and some of these other so-called liberals, Jerry Rubin, and the superficial top-level libs in this country, who is killed and how they're killed never matters to them. They take the day-to-day court cases, take it as an individual case, and even after this person came in and asked for her specifically and shot her down, a gangland style, persons in the Bay Area said there's no indication that there's any political infighting among the prisoners or that it was for political purposes. What they don't understand is that lawyers, judges, radical workers are either being drugged or assassinated. And as we get closer to World War III, those voices that were political in the past will be shut up and silenced forever. They're either drugged or slain, and that's the way it goes. Now, I think one of the things that's interesting in this case is that the person came in and compelled her to write a statement saying, in quotes, that she had betrayed George Jackson and the entire prison movement when they needed me, quote, most, end quotes. Now, this signed confession that she was of no use to the people she helped in those days is a little bit like Jonestown. Remember his assassins and trained assassins or killers were forced to sign slips of confessions that they had killed people and sign confessions of incest and other crimes. And it seems to me that there's a little smelling of this hit team of Jim Jones in getting Faye. Now, Faye worked with Popeye Jackson from the United Prisoners Union. I've talked about him on other tapes. I knew Popeye. I was with him 3 weeks before he was killed. There was somebody at my house, and I felt that my life was in danger by having this person here. I asked him to leave, a former prisoner from who was up at Folsom, and I helped get out of jail and was helping with a lawsuit involving the Watergate story, Elmer Davis. Elmer wanted to see Popeye, and I felt that we were in immediate danger working together here because Popeye was being set up, and I could tell it by the people around him. And 3 weeks later, Popeye Jackson was killed, and Faye Stender is dead. People like Pete McCloskey, who came out as being the so-called left of the Republican Party, are now asking to get the women in the draft, to get the draft going, get ready for the next war. They're coming out of the woodworks and showing their real military feelings. Instead of fighting all wars and ending all armament, they're getting us ready for the next war. People like McCloskey live. Popeye Jackson, Faye Stender, George Jackson, and others are slain. I believe that shooting Faye Stender, who represents the radical liberal lawyer in the Bay Area, is a political act. I believe signing a confession that she's a traitor is a political act. And I also know that the prison system offers a chance to escape or to get parole if they will murder somebody on the outside. And it could be that the authorities in the California prison system have the know that Faye Stender has files, and many people who were put in prison wrongly are suing now. They're getting more aware of their civil rights. Faye Stender was a thorn in the side of the prison system, and I think there would be a lot of reasons to want to get rid of her, particularly since she was representing black people in the Bay Area in Oakland at the time of the COINTEL program, the FBI. And the chief of police over there in Oakland at the time was Charles Gaines, and he's fighting for his life now, his political life, in San Francisco, where he moved over to become chief of police in San Francisco. And last week I talked about him and how his men went into a bar and on the streets and beat up people and started riots. Charles Gaines is involved in counterintelligence, and he was the chief of police over in Oakland at the time that Faye Stender was representing these clients. And Faye wanted a political appointment last year on the state bar's board of governors, and she fought hard for it, and she lost to another attorney, Robert Raven. But Faye knew a lot, and I believe that the prison system could release a person. He asked specifically for Faye Stender and went in and shot her and didn't shoot any of the three other people in the house. Now, one of the things that I've been worried about always is that I worked close with prisoners through this same era up through around 1975. And as I studied more and more about mind control, I got information about prisoners being released from prison to kill, I became very afraid that if I helped prisoners get out or if they corresponded with me, the prison system could brainwash them like they did Donald DeFreeze or these other persons and influence them to come to my house and kill me. And one way that I would be killed would be by former prisoners who were sent by the prison system because of the work I did through all of those years. And I got a letter from a gentleman in San Jose who told me about working with Donald DeFreeze at Vacaville in the SLA, and he had a lot of information on the forming of the SLA. And he also told me that Dr. Jolly West, the CIA psychiatrist, the one that worked with Jack Ruby, and Patty Hearst and Donald DeFreeze, was called Dr. Mengele's up in Vacaville. And I got very suspicious of this because the average prisoner that I knew and corresponded with and the library that they had there that I was somewhat familiar with didn't include the name Mengele's. Mengele's came out with the boys from Brazil, the Nazi doctor that went from Germany down to South America and did experimentations on people. But the average prisoner, or any prisoner, in Vacaville in 1972, 73, 74, did not call Jolly West Mengele's. They didn't know West was in the CIA then. The documents hadn't been released by Senator Church Committee. that West was CIA, and they weren't even aware, other than taking Prolaxin and some of these medications, of the extensive mind control going on. And because I'm always looking for Nazis and on the Nazi hunt, I got suspicious of this particular letter from this prisoner, former prisoner. And he wrote me another letter last week, and he sent me three letters. And I asked him about Mengele's, and he gave some explanation of how he knew the name. And then he said he wanted to come down the house and work with me. He had a lot of information, and he wanted to come with me. And I felt very insecure. He's the one who said that he was given $250,000 by the Watergate people to break into my home, which he described as low and secluded, and seemed to know the physical setup. It was in the letter that he knew the setup of the house. And I got a little bit leery, and psychically, I always say there's some psychic shield around me, I felt very threatened by this particular letter. And I get a lot of mail, but this one really kind of scared me. And I could see a person coming in under the pretense of wanting to work and being sent as a former prisoner and getting the kind of treatment that Faye Stender got. And I wouldn't be surprised if the CIA wanted to get me or to kill me someday. They would do it in the form of a former prisoner who knew someone or corresponded with me in Folsom, Vacaville, or San Quentin, or San Luis Obispo, because I have been in touch with many, many of those and have information on particular guards and deals of parole and drug dealing of guards and where some of them are now. And having that information can be dangerous. And I'm sure that Faye Stender, the attempt was to murder her, and she is close to death, to silence any effort or work she would do on the part of prisoners or to release the information that she has now. A funny thing happens after these critical accidents when people do survive. Nothing more is said about the anger of people that could have caused the very thing that happened. George Wallace shut up. Last week he said, "I have no malice towards Artie Bremer, who shot me. Larry Flint's no longer interested, and he'll kill John Kennedy." Even Bob Dylan, after his near-fatal crash on his motorcycle, went down to make a very mild song in the South he recorded, and now I understand he's turned to Jesus and is becoming Christ lover. He's found Christ. Ever since the hospitalization and the recovery, something strange happens, and the political scene is washed out of the mind, and they become very much part of the establishment they were fighting. In addition to a federal judge being murdered and his primary witness killed, and famous publisher killed, and various international deaths, and a radical lawyer, a juror was killed also in Beverly Hills. Mrs. Cotsen, C-O-T-S-E-N, I'm sure you read about it in your newspapers around the country. Mrs. Cotsen and her 14-year-old son Noah and a third victim who's in critical condition were killed, fatally shot in Beverly Hills, Beverly Drive and Lomitas Avenue. Mrs. Cotsen was working at the municipal court that day. She was a juror in the trial of Iranian students, and a gunman came with a Middle Eastern or European or Arabic accent, and she had lunch, and she never returned to the afternoon session, and the jury convicted Hassan Zarifar of riots or demonstrating in Beverly Hills, but a juror was murdered, and the son was murdered, and another's on critical list. So that a judge, a witness, a juror, a civil rights worker, and students gunned down. But I'm sure that this does a lot to traumatize people. Future judges, future witnesses, future jurors. The intimidation is everywhere. The message comes clear. People have been calling me about these individual cases, but collectively, it's a pretty sick scene, and I do think it's escalating. The articles on deaths and poisoning of some kind of radiations and diseases seem to be filling my boxes of articles much too fast. And unless I'm just more aware of it now, it does seem to be escalating at a fast pace. June the 12th is the anniversary of the birthday of Anne Frank. She'd be 50 years old this June. Her father is still living. He's 90 years old, and he lives in Switzerland. Maybe he's just a few doors away from Adolf Hitler and doesn't even know it, if my information is right about Hitler in the sanitarium there. Anne and her family hid for 25 months, and when the war was over, Mr. Frank went back to some neighbors who discovered her diary, which became very famous. And Anne wrote in that diary, in quotes, "I still believe that people are really good at heart. I can feel the suffering of millions, and yet I look up in the heavens, and I think it will all come right, that this cruelty will end, and that peace and tranquility will return again." End quotes on that. One of the reasons I went into my research is that I never wanted to leave my children the legacy of lies. If things are bad, they're bad. If there's killers loose, they're loose. If they're killing our leaders, they should be discovered. I don't believe things become good by happenstance. I don't think you look up in the heavens and ask the tooth fairy for peace. I think you get peace by studying, by working, by fighting for it. It doesn't fall in your lap. It takes a lot of work to have peace. And the idealism is great. The practicality is what matters. Revolutions and social changes came through hard work, not wishful thinking.